stopped drinking and it was like tearing all these blankets off myself, like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I have like rage sometimes and I have all these other feelings and I have lots of energy and my thoughts are, yeah, my thoughts are clearer. They just were, and they came more quickly and like there was just a lot, I just felt like a lot of more mental activity was happening.
Hi again, everybody. I'm Don Van Natta. Welcome to the final episode of Take a Joke, our new series on humor. This is our second season of what is a new version of the Sunday Long Read podcast. We now unpack captivating journalism themes over the course of 4 or 5 episodes. This season is sponsored by Funny Girls, a program from the Harnish Foundation that uses improv education to strengthen girls' leadership skills. And if you haven't already, please check out The Art of Remembering, the first season of our relaunch, which was all about obituaries. My next guest was one of the most influential media writers and editors of the 2010s. She founded the hilarious women's blog, The Hairpin, and has since become a cartoonist. It's my pleasure to welcome Edith Zimmerman. Edith, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you being here. Edith, it seemed as if you were everywhere in the golden age of internet writing. You worked at the All, a website launched by Corey Sika, who went on to edit the Styles section at the New York Times. You then founded The Hairpin, a hilarious women's blog that I loved reading back then because it always had funny, unique voices. And your work there landed you a spot on Forbes' 30 Under 30. What do you remember about that period of time back in the early 2010s?
I'm a little bit at a loss for how to answer. It was very fun. I'm kind of smiling over here because my life is very different now than back then. But yes, it was extremely fun. The internet was, I don't know, the place to be. It was just thrilling, and I felt like everyone was having a lot of fun, and I was certainly having a lot of fun. I was 28, I think, when The Hairpin started, or maybe 27, and it just felt like a whole flower was opening up and like blossoming, and the internet was just super fun, and there were interesting people doing cool things everywhere, and I felt like lots of great things were starting for me. And yeah, it was just like an awesome time.
Yeah. And my impression from afar reading The Hairpin is it just was a place where the cool kids all hung out. It was kind of the cool kids clubhouse, right?
That's very nice to hear. It felt that way. It felt that way to me. In my mind, I wanted to create a place that I wanted to hang out in and that other people would want to hang out in. And for a little while anyway, it became that place. And it's sort of amazing to imagine that you would be reading it and enjoying it too. It's funny. It's like if at the time I had known stuff like that, I think it would have made me nervous. But yeah, it felt like a very like blithe time. I was just kind of doing whatever and having fun. And at the time, it seemed very natural and like there was no other possible way to be in life. But later, like, I don't know, later I'm like, oh, that was actually kind of like a charmed moment. It's not always like that in the world and in my life and on other people's lives. But it was certainly a wonderful time.
Well, you published so many memorable posts at The Hairpin. One of my favorites is Letters to the Editors of Women's Magazines, which is just... It's wonderful. It's so funny. And we'll link to it with the podcast. How did you develop that humorous voice for The Hairpin?
Well, that was a column that actually started at The All. I was reading a lot of women's magazines at the time, and I came across what I thought was like just a pure absurdity, which is they have these letters sections that are almost always just banal fan mail. Like, I read your article from 2 months ago and I really enjoyed it. It changed my life. Like, from Sarah. And it's like, why are they printing these things? And sometimes they'd be so bizarre, it just led me to want to create like spoof versions of that. And I think jumping off like into the deep end of just like pure absurdity, I don't know, it amused me. There wasn't a lot of thinking going on. It was kind of just like, I don't know, I feel compelled to do this.
What do you mean when you say there wasn't a lot of thinking going on? You mean you would just sort of reflexively find something maybe that was absurd, like those letters, and just say, okay, I'm just going to make fun of this, right? It's a good target.
It was, I guess throughout writing for The Awl and The Hairpin and other humorous things I did, I guess sometimes stuff would just like stand out to me, like it was glowing or something. Like, this is just insane. Like, how can this be here? Like, it's beautiful. It's like beautiful. And I'm almost not, like, I want to say I wasn't trying to make fun of the people who wrote these letters, or it was just the idea that they needed to be published was just, or like how they came to be, because they were clearly so edited or just nonsensical. They seemed emblematic of something that deserved to be laughed at in a way. And so I just wanted to turn up the absurdity to 10 or whatever, and just kind of, yeah, I guess that was the impulse, is like something seems so crazily absurd, I just wanted to like maximize it and have other people enjoy it with me.
A writer named Megan Burbank gave a great tribute to The Hairpin after it shut down. She wrote, "The Hairpin was expressly designed for weird, smart girls like me." I don't mean weird like, LOL, I'm so random. I mean weird like, I don't know how to do makeup. I dress like a 12-year-old boy. I listened to Lorena McKennitt as a teen. And can we seriously get some Jane Eyre jokes going? I just love that. I think that's a pretty good assessment of it. Do you think that's a fair assessment of what you guys are trying to do with The Hairpin?
Yeah, that's so nice. Yes, it just came to be very naturally, and it attracted a really wonderful crowd of people that I I was like, I don't know, the glue of The Hairpin at the beginning anyway. But the vast majority of the content was written by other people, but we had amazing contributors, and it just seemed to attract a certain crowd. And yeah, I'm very moved by that. I'm gonna like replay that in my head when I go to bed tonight.
Yeah, it's great praise. And when I read it, I thought to myself, yeah, that's kind of, you know, how it felt to me as a fan of the site. The Hairpin was a offshoot of The Awl, right? I mean, tell me the origin story of it. How did it get going?
Yeah. So this is, you know, this is a while back, so I'm hoping I don't have my details wrong by now, but it was 2010 and The Awl was pretty popular, and they were approached to start a sister site by a single advertiser. And so I think they got like a chunk of money to start a sister site in exchange for whatever sister site they started would have ads from that advertiser for the first 6 months or 4 months or something, exclusively ads from them. So they reached out to me and to another woman about being the co-editors of the site. And I said yes, and the other woman was like in the process of saying yes, but then she got a raise at her job and she couldn't turn it down, so she stuck at her old job. And I think like the 11th hour was approaching, so they were just the Awl people just said like, okay, well, Edith, you just want to run it by yourself, you can find another editor to join you. And I said sure. And so yeah, it got going very quickly. I think I left the job that I had before that and then started it like a week later or something, or even like the next, just a weekend off. I don't really remember, but yeah, it got started very quickly. Like the first few posts went live and then it was just rolling. And that we had the ads from that advertiser, it was an Ann Taylor ad campaign through Tumblr, I believe. So it was like, it wasn't obvious that it was Ann Taylor ads, but I don't know. This is probably too in the weeds. But so we had that for 3 or 4 months or something. And then I think the idea was that if people were reading it and there were enough page views and our publisher could sell more ads, and it would just sell more ads and hopefully just continue to exist on its own and grow and make money, which it did for a while.
How long did the Hairpin exist?
It closed down in 2018.
Okay.
So about eight years? Yeah.
And I asked Maureen Dowd this question, but you're such a funny writer. I absolutely want to ask you this too. I'm curious to hear your answer. When did you first realize you're funny? Like that you can write funny, but also that you're funny in real life.
I'm like, what did Maureen Dowd say?
Well, you're going to have to listen to that podcast to find out.
I don't know. I remember where I was sitting when I submitted the first letters to the editor of Women's Magazine's installment to the AWE, just like, hey guys, would you want to run this? Like, and I think Corey wrote back to me, because I was friends with Alex Balk, who is the other co-founder, and he had encouraged me to submit, and so I submitted, and Corey wrote back to me, and I'd been a fan of his, but I'd never interacted with him before. And I remember where I was sitting at, like, I don't remember anything about this job I had, because I had a day job, but I was at this computer. I kind of remember what the computer looked like. I remember, like, exactly where it was in this weird room where we were working, and I got an email from him saying, like, oh, this is hilarious, or this is hysterical. We're going to run it. And I admired the AWE so much, and to think that, like, something that I had made would be good enough for their ranks was like, oh, I was like, oh, okay. Maybe this is for real. Like maybe this is something that's doable for me. That's one moment that comes to mind, when you ask that question.
I'm curious if there's anybody or anything really still great about the internet from your perspective in 2023, or is everything as terrible as it seems?
No, I think it's still great, you know, but like yes and no. I don't know. My relationship is totally different. I don't have the time that I used to have. I have a small child. But then also things just changed. It's hard to pinpoint, exactly what it is or what happened. Like,
well, what changed?
I think there's a caution that people have now, and the stakes just seem incredibly high for anyone who's like paying attention, I think, or in my opinion, just like throwing a joke out there is like, I can't even imagine back in the day when it was just something I did all the time without really thinking too hard. Communities are more nestled away, so I don't know. It's like a balance of like, I don't know where anyone is, or I know where everyone is, and it's like overwhelming and kind of cacophonous and terrifying. It's just different. It's just different.
It almost seemed, and this is coming from both a writer perspective as well as a reader, that back then in 2010, 2011, 2012, it was a little bit like the Wild West. If you were writing humor or writing anything and taking chances, there was a safety net. At least there appeared to be, right? So it was a little easier. Now that safety net's gone, you know, and you take a risk and you take a wrong step and you're going to crash. Is that fair?
Yeah, it does seem that way. And even thinking about it, it's like, well, no, I mean, I could have made a big mistake back then and gotten into a lot of trouble, same as now, on like a smaller scale, perhaps, but it could have been the same. You know, Twitter was just beginning, and that's where people really like hung one another's mistakes out. But yeah, it somehow feels a little bit like I had a column in my college newspaper, and it was really fun. It was sort of humorous, and that was what sparked my interest in becoming a writer. But I'm like incredibly glad that for the most part, I think those are all not online, you know? And it was nice to have that insulated sense, which I don't know, made me feel much more comfortable at the time, freer. And I can't really think of anywhere right now where I have that sense of freedom or comfort. I mean, I even have a personal newsletter now, but something I don't know, it's different. I'm like trying to come up with better words to describe how I feel about this, but it just is different. And it's a sense of there's lots of people, but you don't know who they are or where they are. And it just, it's lots of tripwires everywhere.
Yeah. Tripwires is a good analogy. It almost doesn't feel as safe. Right. And by the way, where'd you go to college and what newspaper did you write your first pieces for?
I went to Wesleyan and I wrote for the Wesleyan Argus.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of tripwires. It's difficult. I mean, would you ever want to go back to doing kind of a cultural critique? I mean, I know you have your newsletter, but similar to what you were doing, you know, at the Hairpin a decade ago?
Yeah, I would. And I've like put some thought into some of it. I mean, I like the implicit cultural critique when people make jokes or like, I don't know, cartoons or something humorous where you understand why it's funny immediately and it has something to do with like the way our world is working right now. And instead of reading like a more straightforward critique of something, like, oh, this is why this is bad and blah, blah, blah. It's like oftentimes, you know, you can make a really funny short thing and it accomplishes the job much better. Like, that would be fun. But that stuff, I don't know, it doesn't come to me as easily as it comes to other people. And I don't think I have the confidence right now to be very critical, like openly critical of certain things. But maybe that's not relevant.
Edith, one of the things I really like about your work is there's a vulnerability to your writing, even or maybe even especially in some of your funniest pieces, whether you're framing yourself as the unwitting recipient of actor Chris Evans's flirtations in that GQ profile, or you're drawing the many dimensions of sobriety and alcohol recovery. How do you tap into that honesty?
I don't know. I mean, I think to a certain extent, it just comes naturally to me. I want to tell people what really happened because I think it's funny and it makes for a more realistic exchange. I don't know. I'm like, well, I can't really imagine doing it differently.
This season of the SLR podcast is supported by our publisher, Ruth Ann Harnish, and we're excited to tell you about another great thing she's a part of. It's called Funny Girls, and it helps 3rd through 8th graders as they figure out all the changes they're navigating. To do so, Funny Girls uses improv exercises, lighthearted activities that actually contain important lessons in leadership. The kids have a lot of laughs, but they also learn how to think on their feet, how to come up with creative ideas, and how to recognize their own abilities. Kelly Clarkson featured Funny Girls on her show. Just Google Kelly Clarkson Funny Girls, and you can see the whole thing. Have a potential eligible student in your life, or just want to know more? Visit www.funnygirls.org. That's www.funnygirls.org. Thanks again to Ruth Ann for her support of young women, this show, and the Sunday Long Read. In recent years, you veered toward comics and illustrations. What made you start leaning into those and away from writing and blogging?
Well, there's some like more boring reasons. Like, I had a job that was kind of ending because my editor was leaving. But I had started doing comics in a time when I wasn't working at all, and it was this like, I don't know. I had after the Hairpin, I didn't work for a long time, and I was drinking more and more and doing nothing, and that went on for a while, and then I stopped drinking. And when I stopped drinking, like, the world just totally changed for me, slowly, not like suddenly or anything, but it was very exciting. And I found I had a lot to say about it, and I had all these big feelings, and I was like, oh my God, this, yeah, like blah, 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 blah. And I kept a journal that I was aggressively writing in every morning when I drank my coffee. And like, instead of going to bars at night, I went to coffee shops in the morning and wrote forever in this journal. And then I started keeping a second journal that was just drawings that I felt like making, because that was fun for whatever reason. And then the two journals kind of merged, and I started drawing and writing on the same page. And then I just started drawing, and then they took the form of more traditional comics. And then I was just drawing and drawing and drawing those. And eventually I started sharing them in a, on an Instagram account, and it was private, but I invited my friends to join, and I would just share little snippets from the journal every day or every other day, with little moments from my life that for some reason felt like they had been captured correctly or humorously or in a way that I felt was worthy of sharing with my friends. And that just seemed like it was a very powerful fountain. Like, these comics were just coming out of me every day. They were just comics about what I was doing or what I'd overheard at the coffee shop or what, you know, whatever had happened to me the day before. And they were satisfying in a way I didn't anticipate, but really enjoyed. Anyway, and then simultaneously, I got a job. I was working for The Cut at New York Magazine, and then that job kind of came to an end, and because my editor left, and I quit because I thought maybe I could take the momentum from the Instagram comics and start a newsletter and feature them there instead. And so I did that, and I did that. That was about 4 years ago, and I've been doing the newsletter like sort of ever since, except not really, because I stopped about a year ago. I can't even really remember what your question was.
Well, no, I was just asking about, you know, how you pivoted to comics. I didn't realize that it was after you quit drinking, and you know, I do want to ask you about that. So, did you find you were just more creative, more, I mean, what exactly did that do for your work output? So, certainly it sounds as if you were, you had this surge of creativity, right? And in a different way.
Yeah, yeah.
Journaling and everything else. But I had no idea that your comics, you know, your move to doing comics was related to that or motivated by that, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I just had a lot more. Well, it's funny, like, in retrospect, like, yeah, that was, it was more creativity, but also just at the time, it just felt like more energy. Like, I wasn't hungover, and I woke up every morning with, like, tons of energy to just do stuff. And I found, I guess I should say, part of the reason I started the journals was because I had felt kind of burned out on internet writing, and there was something about writing by hand that felt much safer. Like, there was no chance that I could copy and paste it and publish it anywhere. It's like just writing by hand. And I can type like really, really fast. And that's both helpful and kind of can be like, I don't know, misleading, personally misleading. Like, you find yourself typing like incredibly fast, and you've written like two or three pages like in a whirlwind, and it's like, oh, these are all garbage. Like, but if you just start, if, I don't know, I was writing by hand, and that felt like therapeutic to a certain extent. So I was writing by hand and drawing by hand, and I just had lots of things to say and had little personal revelations about like, oh my God, this is why I was drinking, or this is why it's great to not be drinking, or like, this is why this thing has had, and just writing them down for myself. And then after a while, there was this bits of it that I wanted to share. And so then I felt more comfortable sharing it. But yeah, for a long time, a lot of that stuff was just private.
I do want to ask you one other thing about the decision to quit drinking, because I actually stopped drinking just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. And I feel like so much better already. Like, I sleep better. I wake up with more energy.
Yeah.
I always worked out, but my workouts are better. I feel like my brain is just clearer thinking, you know? Did you find all that, like, early on in the first few weeks?
Yeah. Too? Well, like, that's part of why I had this, like, insane journal. I was just like, I have so many thoughts. I need to put them down. And I have, like, it was pouring out. And I think I felt dead. I mean, I was drinking a lot, and I was not, like, to the point where, like, I did not have a workout routine before I stopped drinking. So the contrast was probably more extreme for me than it is for you. But, I went from feeling like my personality was, like, kind of dead. Like, oh, I'm just kind of, like, I don't have many feelings. Like, I don't have much drive. Like, I'm just kind of here. And then I stopped drinking, and it was, like, tearing all these blankets off myself. Like, whoa. I have, like, rage sometimes, and I have all these other feelings, and I have lots of energy, and my thoughts are clearer. And they came more quickly, and, like, there was just a lot. I just felt like a lot of more mental activity was happening.
Yeah, I've absolutely felt the same way, and so I think I'm gonna, not do it again for a while, or maybe ever. I don't know. I mean, I definitely think it's helped me get ready to write this book too. I mean, it's only been 2 weeks, so we'll see. But yeah, it was one morning I woke up, I'm like, I don't want to feel like this anymore.
Yeah, so, that's what happened to me too. It wasn't even like I had some like car accident or something. I just woke up and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, this is boring. Like, my life is boring. I need this to, because I've been trying to balance like drinking too much and continuing with my life for like years. I knew I drank too much, but then I was just like, I think I just got to toss it. Like, I'm done.
Just stop it. And your liver is in a lot better condition right now than it was.
I hope
that,
so. Yeah.
Because it heals itself. Your liver heals itself.
It was very nice to read that stuff. Like, oh, this is the speed at which these things regenerate or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever happens with you, like, it's such a worthwhile, experiment or perspective. Just be like, oh, wow. Like, this is like a reset. Like, oh, this is what it feels like to not have. Cause even when I stopped drinking it, there were things that I figured I knew what was going to happen, but then what actually happened was so much more extreme. Like
what?
Like just, yeah, I figured that I wasn't someone who had a lot of feelings. It's like, no, I do have lots of feelings. Or the things I ended up wanting to change were just so much more, the amount that my drinking had taken over my life was far more than I had thought, even when I stopped drinking. Like, it was like, if I stop drinking, I'm sure things will get better. It's like, not only do things get better, they get like worse and weirder. And it's just like so much. I created so much space for myself. When I thought I was only clearing off like a shelf, it's like clearing out an entire room or house or something.
Wow. So many of your comics, they, as you were saying, they depict these kind of slice of life scenes that are sometimes even kind of dreamy and almost fantasy-like. And yet others are just very, very cutting and hilarious. One of your cartoons I love is of a woman staring gloomily at her phone, and the caption reads, "The algorithm surfaced it for me, but it was so pretty I liked it anyway." Just a great sentence. And, so again, it's obviously you're combining art with the words and very, very different from what you were doing previously. And as you said, you're burnt out from internet writing. What about your life right now gives you creative inspiration?
My impulse is to say nothing. but that's not true. I still draw a lot of comics. I just don't publish them. Something happened after my daughter turned one or something. There was something about the, I really can't put my finger on it. I haven't published anything in a long time. And I just keep it all private. I mean, I'm not, this is like not my most, there's not a lot of great output coming from me, which I don't, I mean, I kind of miss, but I don't feel bad about it. It's like maybe this is just a, like a low-key phase. But, I mean, I draw a lot of pictures of her. I draw comics of interactions I have with my husband or just I still do the same stuff, like slice of life moments. I just don't publish anything. And I puzzle over why, and I'm not exactly sure. I mean, none of it really seems that good, but also sort of, I don't know, sometimes I wonder if the thing I wanted, which was bigger and bigger audiences and like more and more success, also has the effect of being sort of silencing, like, I don't know. Like, some of these are so personal. It's like, my God, what am I doing? Like, sharing these with thousands and thousands of people. Like,
Well, do you think the work that you've been doing that you've not shown to anybody, you know, in recent months or last year or so, that eventually you will share it at some point?
I don't know. I would like to believe it. It's like, oh, maybe I'm working on a secretly amazing, like, personal memoir. But I think that's mostly delusion. So I really don't know. I have no idea what's next.
Have you thought, Edith, about maybe something you want to write about, or maybe, you know, beyond the comics, is there, you know, maybe a memoir inside of you or a novel or, you know, something different? Is there anything like that that you've ever thought about trying?
Oh yeah. I wish I could write a novel. But I have no ideas really. I mean, I would like to just get a regular job again, writing for a website or something. I'm going to have another child in a couple months. And so I'm probably...
Oh, congrats.
Thanks. So I'm probably just like still on the mom churn.
You were asked this in a previous interview, and it's a little bit of a forward looking question too, since we're in that part of this discussion. But I love this question that you were asked, so I'm going to steal it and ask it. If you were to create a new publication, if you had an opportunity after your second child was born, you're getting back into the workforce, what would you call the new publication and what would you like the subject to be?
Well, I hope I answered it in a good way in the other the other time. I'm like, well, I guess to go recheck that. I would say I have absolutely no idea. Something between like, I'm just very in the mom zone right now, and it would be cool. There's like a plenty of good parenting blogs and newsletters and sites, but I don't know. There's none that make me feel like I really want to hang out there a lot. Or they do, but it's not quite the same. I don't know. So maybe something parenting, but also, it would be cool. I like reading book reviews, but I almost never want to like actually get the book, because I feel like they don't want like most of the new books, like most new books just don't really interest me. So if there was some kind of book review that was like about old books and it was just people reviewing books they loved or had something to say about that were from any time, anywhere, and could take the form of a poem or a cartoon or something that was just like 100 words. And it was just tons of interesting people submitting these weird book reviews, and it was called, like, Reviewing Old Books or something like that. I mean, I'm sure it exists somewhere. That's the other bad part about the internet, is, like, any good idea you have is, like, oh, now someone's already doing it, like, 10 times better than you could. But
yeah, but I would love what you just described. I would love that. That is so cool. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of what Jack Schaefer does for the Sunday Long Read. He picks one piece a week, a classic piece of journalism. It can be from like 1890 or 1960,
yeah,
or from 2 years ago, and then writes this very cool eclectic paragraph or two about it that makes you want to read it instantly. And if you did that for books, and did it, as you say, with different, in different medium, right? Like, you know, you do cartoons or you do, you know, whatever, a poem or some ode to it in a different way with that. That's a great idea. I'm signing up for that that Substack right now.
Yeah,
if you
thanks.
Create that, that's a great idea. That's cool, and I'd love to contribute to it. It'd be fun.
Wow. I'll keep you to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious what advice you'd give Edith to a young Edith, someone like you, just starting out, wanting to write funny stuff or perceptive stuff or essays or anything, somebody just coming out of college, looking to do what you did, you know, when you first started going?
Well, what was very helpful to me may not even exist really today. I had a personal blog that's no longer online, but it was a place where I just wrote little stories or jokes or experimental, like, just weird little blog posts. And I just did it purely for fun. And that was a big deal, I think, for me. Just the amount of writing I just did for fun or for free for so long was, I can't imagine where I would be without it. And I know that the world is different now, so that's not even obviously, like, I don't even know where people would find that or do that, but...
Yeah, but there's a great lesson in that, right? Like, if you're not writing under pressure, you're writing only for yourself, you're writing for free, obviously you're getting the reps that you need. All writers, we all have to, you know, continue using that muscle or it atrophies. And So that's good advice for a young writer, even if it's not necessarily in a blog where an audience can see it. But, you know, write for yourself and keep doing it as much as you can until you, you know, feel comfortable enough to put it out into the world.
Yeah, I don't know if this sounds bad or good or whatever. I don't know, but like, there's every so often there'll be debates about like, oh, you know, never write for free or never, you know. And I get where people are coming from with that, but I personally benefited so much from writing for free before I even thought about trying to sell anything that I was writing. It was just something I enjoyed doing. And I've had moments where I just go dark and go back into that. Like, I'm just doing it for myself somehow, some way, and maybe I'll share it with people later. But just like public sharing and then just going back in and writing privately. Like, there's a cycle. There's been a cycle in there for me. And it's hard to, I don't know, it's hard to respect that when so many people seem to be just like excellent all the time. Like publicly excellent all the time. But yeah, phases of just doing it quietly, privately. It's like, yeah.
Edith, thanks so much for your time today. This was the last episode of Take a Joke, the second series from the Sunday Long Read podcast. And the season has been sponsored by Funny Girls, a program from the Harnish Foundation that uses improv education to strengthen girls' leadership skills. The Sunday Long Read podcast is an audio extension of the Sunday Long Read newsletter. Since 2014, the SLR has curated the very best journalism every week and drops in your inbox every Sunday morning. Find us at www.sundaylongread.com. And you can subscribe to the Sunday Long Read podcast on Spotify or Apple to make sure you don't miss a single future episode. This episode was produced by Veronica Dixon-Larada and Alex Fuse. The executive producer of the podcast is Etienne Lejoie, and the founders of the Sunday Long Read are Jacob Feldman and me, Don Van Natta. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us again in season 3. Talk to you soon.